When did you first see The Searchers, and what drew you to the film?
Well, you know, I think the first time must have been when I was maybe 10 or 12 years old, and saw it on television in that sort of black and white cut-up version. Even then, it seemed to stand out as slightly different than the average, you know, cowboy and Indian movie that was our main fare growing up in Rochester, New York. The first time, though, it really had impact on me was when I saw it at Columbia University several years later in a film course. It was on the big screen in full VistaVision and color, and it was just so beautiful and so powerful. There's something, you know, the emotions that are displayed in The Searchers really affected me then and still do. I think I've seen it 15 or 20 times, and I still sort of have tears in my eyes at several points. So it just made a personal connection with me. I know I'm not alone. It had made a personal connection with some very much more famous people like Steven Spielberg and George Lucas and Martin Scorsese when they saw it as young people. It had a formative impact on, you know, who they became, and they've been quoting from it ever since. But that's where it started, with the movie and just with this sort of emotional power.
And when did you take it from that emotional power to really wanting to find out the history of the story behind it, about Cynthia Ann Parker and Alan LeMay's novel, and how that was inspired by her own true story of abduction at the hands of the Comanche Indians here in Texas?
Well, I knew nothing about any of that. You know, when you grow up in Texas and you go to school here, Cynthia Ann is, you know, in the curriculum in public school. Well, it's not on the curriculum in Rochester, New York. And so I was surprised. I thought I was starting off just to do a sort of making of the movie kind of book. I knew there would be a contextual chapter about captivity narratives, maybe chapter two. But I figured that would be it. And then I'd go back to the movie, but it didn't take very long. Once I started looking into The Searchers, both Alan LeMay's novel and the film, didn't take long to hear Cynthia Ann Parker's name. Online, it was pretty easy suddenly to find out who she was and some of the details. Then I found myself coming to Texas and meeting with members of the, you know, heirs, if you will, of her family who are still around, both the Comanche side and the Texan side. So very, very quickly, the thing expanded from being a movie book to being a book about America and about the way we tell stories and the way the stories we tell gradually take on this kind of mythic status.
You know, we can never know the full truth of what happened, but how did Cynthia Ann Parker's story begin, and how was it modified and embellished over the decades?
Well, the basic story is pretty simple. A 9-year-old girl is with her extended family. They've settled in sort of central eastern Texas on a fortified farm. And one day in May of 1836, a group of Kiowa and Comanches come along. And an attack occurs. 5 people are killed, including her father and her grandfather. And 5 young people are captured, including 9-year-old Cynthia Ann. She spends 24 years with the Comanche. She marries a Comanche. She has 3 Comanche children. And then one day in December 1860, another group of raiders come to the village she's living in. Only this time it's U.S. Cavalry and Texas Rangers. And people around her, the dear ones, are killed again. She and her little daughter, Prairie Flower, a baby, are captured. And, you know, and it seems like they're about to kill her. She looks like a Comanche woman. But then they notice she has blue eyes. And so they take her back to Camp Cooper. They figure out along the way this must be Cynthia Ann Parker. She's already sort of a known mythic figure, you know, in Texas history. They get in touch with her family, and she's restored to the Parker family. The only problem is, of course, that she's become a Comanche. She doesn't want to be back with Texans. She doesn't want to be embraced in Christendom. She wants to be back with the Comanche family, with her sons, with her husband, with her village. And so it becomes a very tragic tale. For the second time, she's been the traumatized victim of the Comanche-Texan wars.
And in the meantime, people have been looking for her.
her uncle, James, who had been on the settlement, who had escaped the attack, comes searching for her and the other four young people who'd been captive. And he manages over time to get the other four back, but he never gets Cynthia Ann back. It's 8 years on and off that he searches for her. He writes a narrative of his own account. And, you know, James is telling the story both to justify what he's done and who he is. So immediately, right from the start with Cynthia Ann, you have people coming along, taking the basic story, embellishing it a bit, changing parts of it to fit their needs and their sensibility. In the same way, after this, you know, raid, you know, after the Texas Rangers and the cavalry free her, you have people like Sewell Ross, who was the Texas Ranger captain helping lead that raid, describing what happened, and his version of it changes over time. So everybody uses this basic, simple tale and tells it the way they need to tell it, and gradually, you know, it's very hard to sort out fact from fiction here. There are very few facts that really are reliable, but that we can count on. So my book becomes as much about the making of the myth and how that happens over time and how each generation comes along and retells this thing to fit their own needs and their own sensibility. And what starts as a simple story becomes a basic Texas foundational myth.
What is it about the captivity story that so captures the public's imagination? It's a narrative that's told over and over again in different settings. What is it that people in the 1800s were latching onto with this captivity story and captivity myth?
The same thing that people coming to America had been doing with it since really the 17th century. The first American bestseller, if you will, was Mary Rowlandson in 1682, writing about her captivity by Narragansett Indians in New England. There's something about being in this land and having the other savages, these people, these natural, scary people come and take you, take your family, take your wife, take your children, and haul them off into the wilderness. It's scary. It's a little bit sexy. It raises all of these difficult issues. At the same time, besides all of the sort of personal and psychological tension involved, it becomes, if you will, sort of a justification for the conquest of the West. Because if these natives are going to come forward and, you know, steal our women and children, then we have the right to conquer them. We have the right to tame them. So it's part of the imperial narrative, too. It serves both purposes. And an important part of all this is the question of sex with Indians, of what happens to these women when they're taken off. They're forced to have sex with Indians, either willingly, unwillingly, it doesn't matter. It becomes known as a fate worse than death, the idea that you would be forced in this position. So there are these psychological, psychosexual tensions involved. There are these imperial notions. And Americans continue to tell these stories. At the same time, around the time Cynthia Ann was kidnapped in 1836, if you look at the bestseller list, three of the four top bestsellers in America are James Fenimore Cooper novels, all of whom have captivity themes going on in them. And then the fourth one was a nonfiction book about Mary Jameson, a woman who was captured by Seneca Indians in upstate New York back in the 18th century. So this is something that continues on. It continues on into Texas. And really throughout our history, this has been an important genre.
Well, in many of our contemporary movies that involve Native Americans, they're portrayed as very noble people now, like in Dances with Wolves or in Terrence Malick's The New World. Back in the 1950s, when the novel and the film of The Searchers came out, it wasn't uncommon for Native American tribes to be depicted as just really violent toward the white man, and it had been that way for quite some time. But it seems that based on history, there really was quite a lot of, at least with the Comanche tribe, scariness. Talk about the reality of the Comanche versus the fictional depictions in book and film.
Well, Comanches were nomadic warriors on the limestone plains in North Texas. I mean, it was a tough place to make a living. Their birth rate was low. Their resources were scarce. They became wonderful horsemen, maybe the best horsemen of all Native American groupings. And they were great, you know, in terms of buffalo, and they had huge horse herds, and they were labor intensive. So they needed outsiders. They could be enormously kind and generous to each other with kinship ties and protection, but they could be very cruel to outsiders because of this warrior culture. And so, but you have to put it in context, both of what they were up against and, of course, that they became involved in a 40-year protracted war with Texans, the longest war really fought on American soil. And this was a real clash of civilizations. I mean, these two cultures shared nothing in common. And so, and it also was an intimate war in that the, you know, in some wars, okay, it's two armies fighting against each other. And if, you know, civilians get killed, gee, we're really sorry about that. That's collateral damage. Well, in the Texan Comanche Wars, the families, in essence, were the targets. Each side was out to wipe out the other side, to wipe out its culture, to wipe out its family. It becomes a very intimate war in that sense. There are no drones. You're killing the person you're fighting. You're looking in the face as you kill him or her, or as you abduct their family. And so it's a horrifying event in many ways, and it brings out incredible cruelty on both sides, I would argue.
Let's go back again now to how the narratives of these stories were recounted. And how did Alan LeMay, the author of the book, The Searchers, get into writing Westerns and decide to adapt the story into a novel?
Well, I was very happy that I was able to write about Alan LeMay. He's kind of an overlooked figure. There isn't even a photo of him on the internet anywhere. And I went and found his, you know, 23 boxes of his files at UCLA archives. I met his family, his son Dan, who was very helpful. Alan began as a novelist. He was out to make money. He saw Westerns as a pretty lucrative way to cash in as a writer. He wrote a lot of short stories. And then, you know, he goes to Hollywood because he figures there's even more money to be made there, and he becomes a sort of itinerant screenwriter. By the early 1950s, he's kind of fed up with that life. He's written a lot of screenplays. It's sort of feast or famine for him. And he wants to get back to what he loves best, which is the Western novel. And he's out making a B-Western in the Texas Panhandle when he comes across, I think when he hears about this story about Cynthia Ann and her Comanche son, Quanah. He journeys over to East Texas and meets members of the Parker family. But he's really interested in the uncle more than he is in the captive. He's interested in the impact of the violence on the family that's left behind, if you will. And so that's where his focus is. And he creates these two searchers. One is an uncle. In the book, he's called Amos Edwards, modeled, you know, a bit on James Parker, an Indian hater, an Indian fighter, someone who knows Indian lore, knows who the Comanches are. And then another fictional character, an adopted younger brother, he calls Martin Pauley. And these two guys search in the novel for something like 7 years. For the character, and it really focuses on this quest. The quest is another great literary genre, right, or theme that goes back to, you know, to the Odyssey. And so they're on a quest to find this little girl, and it takes them through the dying days of Comanche power. It's a wonderful novel, incidentally, kind of grim, but beautifully written.
So in the movie, Amos has become Ethan Edwards, played by John Wayne, and he really hates the Comanche. There's a lot of critical writing since The Searchers came out that explicitly talks about his racial hatred of the Comanche. What are some of the differences between James Parker, the real-life uncle of Cynthia Ann Parker, Amos Edwards in the novel, and the way it eventually became Ethan Edwards, really the role of John Wayne's career, a terrific role?
Yes, I agree with you. It really is an amazing role. Anyone who thinks that John Wayne wasn't an actor, I would ask you to watch The Searchers and then see if you still have the same opinion. Well, you know, it begins with James Parker, who's a sort of devout religious person, but at the same time turns out to be a kind of heavy drinker. He's a bit of an outlaw. He says he knows Indians and understands Indian lore, but he's very unsuccessful, and the narrative he leaves behind is a bit self-pitying. We move on, you know, to the novel and then to the film. What the film does is take this man and really raise him to the surface. He becomes the most powerful figure in the movie because he's being played by John Wayne, but he's a dark figure. And what happens over the course of the movie that's so fascinating is he starts out trying to rescue his 9-year-old niece. But as time goes on, she grows from being a young woman to from being a little girl to being a young woman. And over the 7 years, and she becomes grown and becomes a Comanche wife. And so she has had sex with Indians, willingly or not. And so, and his quest over time turns into, you know, changes. It morphs. Originally, he's trying to rescue her. But as time goes on and she's been polluted, you know, in this way, he decides he's going to kill her. And that becomes the sort of narrative tension that drives the movie forward. What's going to happen when Uncle Ethan finally catches up with this little girl? Is he really going to kill his niece, or is something else going on? And John Wayne does a beautiful job of capturing all of the conflict that's going on within Ethan Edwards as to what to do. On one level, he's sure he has to do this, this terrible deed. He becomes this dark knight who, rather than rescue the damsel, he decides he's going to kill the damsel. At the same time, though, we're never quite sure what he's going to do. He's still John Wayne, after all. He's very charismatic. We want him to succeed. But at the same time, we recoil from his mission. And it's that tension that really drives the movie forward.
John Ford, who directed the film, was notoriously tight-lipped about the deeper themes in his movies. There's a famous interview with Peter Bogdanovich that I've seen a few times where Ford is basically saying no comment to every question Bogdanovich asks of him about the themes in his films. How do you think Ford approached The Searchers, and why did his Westerns get darker over time? And did he ever drop any hints to you, or not to you, but did he ever drop any hints that you found about the deeper meaning of any of his films, especially The Searchers?
Oh, he recoiled from talking about deeper meaning. You know, when I think of who I would love to have interviewed, I'd love to have interviewed John Wayne. He was such a generous guy and a lot of fun to talk to. Ford, I'm not so sure, because as you say, he could be pretty withering, even to Peter Bogdanovich, who he liked a lot. He did tell Bogdanovich that The Searchers was a psychological epic. He didn't define what he meant by that, of course. He left it hanging there, but I think that's exactly right. Ford, by the time he makes The Searchers, is in his early 60s. This is the work of an older, mature man. He's had physical health problems. He's a lifelong alcoholic, and he's wrestling with that. His vision gets darker and more complex. So in Searchers, I would argue, is his ultimate Western. He's very good at giving us all of the iconic themes of the Western. He helped invent them, after all. The lone man, you know, the laconic hero on horseback, who, using gun violence, tames the West, whether it's killing the bad guys or, you know, killing the barbarian Native Americans. All that's there, and it's, you know, it's a piece of its time. There are racist connotations to all of that. But at the same time, he's giving you the hero, if you will. He's also undermining the meaning of it because, again, as I'd mentioned earlier, this is a hero who does some terrible things. He shoots the eyes out of one corpse, of an Indian corpse. He scalps an Indian corpse. He shouts down a funeral service for the victims of an Indian raid so he can get on with his vengeance and move on. And he's going to kill his young niece because she's had sex with Indians. And so Ford he's giving you the racism. There's plenty of that. And yet at the same time, he's undermining it. And that's the power of The Searchers. And that's a mature work of a man who really is comfortable, I would argue, with ambiguity. You're right. We don't have many notes from Ford, and he certainly didn't articulate much of this. But when you read the final shooting script of the film, and then you see what Ford actually shot, what actually is in the movie, you see him making a lot of interesting choices to eliminate dialogue, to eliminate exposition. The characters aren't explaining themselves verbally as to why they do the things they do. Instead, he's telling it visually. It's visual storytelling. And you have to make up your own mind as to why the uncle does what he does during the movie and how it ends and what it means. You have to decide. And that's the kind of ambiguity that I would argue raises The Searchers from, you know, a pretty good cowboys and Indian movie to something much more approaching cinematic art.
As I watched John Ford's films and the way Indians are depicted in his films over time, I began to wonder what Ford's feelings were about Native Americans and our relationship and legacy with them. And then I read in your book about how he was presented with a sacred deerskin by the Navajo tribe on the set of The Searchers, and he considered that to be a higher honor than even winning his 4 Oscars. And that's really telling, I think.
Yeah, I agree. And he really meant it. I talked to Harry Carey Jr., who was a supporting actor in the movie, and I said, you know, did this mean a lot to Ford? And he said, oh, yeah, this was real. Ford was very smitten by this. He treated the Navajo in Monument Valley, you know, where he shot these films, very paternalistically. He made sure they got paid and they got fed. They were happy to have him come out there because it meant work, of course. But it was very much a paternalistic relationship of almost the great white father handing, you know, gifts to, you know, to his native subjects. Ford was a man of his time. It's pointless to say that he didn't have, that there wasn't some racism involved, that there wasn't paternalism. That's just the way people were. But he had this beautiful way of being able to sort of give you that, and yet at the same time, he knew there was more to it. And he killed a lot of Native Americans in his westerns. They're not treated so well, and the Searchers, the Comanches, are largely killers and rapists for that matter. Eventually, he makes his final Monument Valley western, his Cheyenne Autumn, which is much more of a mea culpa, if you will. It's much more told from the Native American point of view, and it's fascinating to see. I would not put the Searchers in that category. The Searchers is much rougher on Native Americans, as they say. And, you know, Ford both appreciated who they were. He had a great respect and admiration for the Navajo who worked with him. At the same time, he used Indians, you know, as the sort of evil other at times in order to fit the stories he was telling.
Finally, I think it's pretty amazing that this horrible event happened in 1836. And as you write in the book, just before The Searchers was written as a novel and released as a film, after all these years of history had gone by, there was a meeting between the Parker families and the Comanche descendants of Cynthia Ann's son, Quanah Parker. And over the years, now, they've come to where they have family reunions and they attend each other's family events. As you write in the book, they even, you know, offer tokens of appreciation over the years to each other. That's really pretty amazing.
It's a great American story. Early on, I got to go to one of the Comanche family reunions in 2008, and they were so generous and welcoming. And, you know, they held powwows. They did various things right at a place called the Star House, which was Quanah Parker's home, which is still standing in Cache, Oklahoma. And so right away, you could see from their point of view how much they venerated their ancestors, both Quanah and Cynthia Ann. And then to go to the Texas reunion a couple of weeks later, and again, you're right, there were emissaries back and forth. They trade a silver bowl every year. They share these ancestors, and they share the story, and they tell it slightly differently, some of them. But nonetheless, they know that this is, you know, that this is what grounds them and their family in American history. And it gives it a, you know, I've gone back three times to reunions since then. It really becomes a contemporary event with meaning, I think, to this day, because how was America built, after all? Out of this terrible war, out of these terrible struggles, and yet today we are one nation. We have a president who comes from two different backgrounds, and in the same way, many of the Parkers have one foot in the Comanche world and one foot in the Texan or the white world. That kind of blend is what America's all about, and I found it to be a very resonant, and I closed the book with that because, to me, it's very resonant about who we are and basically how we got here.